Interview with Robert Kippers, November 10th, 2010, in Washington, D.C., by Kenneth Durr. So we're looking at, with the exception of some time with the SEC, we're looking at a career with Deloitte, very much.
Largely.
Did you go into Deloitte right out of college?
I did. I graduated in 1976, and at the time, the accounting profession consisted of eight, you know, the old Big Eight. I was one of those kids that was lucky enough to get eight offer letters, and I ended up, this is Minneapolis, I ended up going with Haskins and Sells, partly because I knew somebody there and seemed like a really good guy, and figured I had to pick one of them. Why not Haskins and Sells?
Okay. Tell me a little bit about your work, what you found when you got into that.
Well, starting out as a staff auditor, really. Some of the realities of working with clients were pretty new, because I never worked professionally before, but immediately was assigned to a 12-week assignment out of town in a little tiny city up in northern Minnesota, and with all the travel and the back and forth, it wasn't particularly glamorous, but I found the work to be as challenging as promised. So I immediately took to it. And, auditing is, over the 35 years, has really been a passion of mine. But early days, it's all about who you work for, how they train you, what the sensitivities are, the tricks of the trade or the little tips to make you more effective in your job. And as a young person, you're like a sponge. You absorb it as fast as you can. So I really did enjoy the work.
Tell me a little bit about, the firms have their own character. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about Haskins and Sells and what you soaked up about the legacy and what you were supposed to uphold there.
Well, Haskins and Sells, again, eight firms, and certainly wasn't the largest. But its legacy, as with many of the firms, was long term, dating back to the late 19th century. But the real what Haskins and Sells was known for were two things. One, one of the most significant auditors of the brokerage industry, the big bulge bracket firms on Wall Street, but also large industrial clients, and in many ways has developed during those early years, came to be known as sort of the auditor's auditor, kind of a distinction, a pride, if you will. And it always felt like the right place to me, maybe because I didn't know any other, but it felt good to be part of a firm that had such a strong legacy.
Were you able to get involved with other areas of the profession, the AICPA or anything like that, in these early years, or were you focused on the firm?
I was focused on client assignments and getting the work done and trying to get a good evaluation at the end of it and the best kind of raise I could get. But very early in my career, at 5 years, I was approached by one of our senior partners who said, I've got an offer you should consider. I said, okay. He said, here at Haskins and Sells, we don't make managers until you have 6 years of experience. However, you're doing very well. So at 5 years, we would consider promoting you early, provided you're willing to move to New York City and take an assignment in our national office. That just seemed like an offer that was too good to refuse. And plus, I'd never lived anywhere but where I grew up. And so my wife and I, in 1981, came to New York.
Called up to the big leagues, so to speak.
Well, it felt that way to me, I figured they wouldn't make that offer to people they didn't trust to do well. So that's when I first had the purview of my job changed, and I started working with people outside Haskins and Sells, and by then it was called Deloitte Haskins and Sells,
okay.
and began to know people in the other firms. So it was my first view of the profession, more broadly speaking.
Uh-huh. Now, was it shortly after that that you got involved with the Professional Accounting Fellowship?
It was, because the assignment in New York was a very clear 23-month duration. In those days, there were some tax advantages to structuring it that way. But at the 22nd month, I kind of decided that I really liked New York and came up with a value proposition for the partners at the time saying, you know, you really can't afford to lose me right now. I should stay a third year. And they readily agreed. It was during that third year when one of the young partners who had returned from the SEC just a couple years before approached me and said, you shouldn't go back to Minneapolis. You should apply to be a professional accounting fellow at the SEC, because he had done that very thing.
Who was that?
Steve Golub. Okay. Steve is with Lazard today. He's a partner at Lazard, been very successful, a bit of a mentor to me in those days. And then I started to learn that the PAF program, as it's called, was highly competitive, which didn't really surprise me. But there were many more applicants than positions available. In those days, they would pick two a year, and there would be 8, 10, 12 applications. So the odds didn't seem very good. But indeed, I succeeded in getting that appointment. So that took me from New York to Washington in 1984.
Did you interview with the chief accounting officer?
I interviewed with the chief accountant and his staff, his folks. But the most interesting thing was, in those days at least, there was a dinner at the end of the day, and the chairman would come to the dinner. And, of course, that's a pretty big deal for a young manager in an accounting firm. But the chairman would actually interview in his own way over dinner all of these candidates. And I don't remember the specific question that was directed at me, but I know at the time I felt my answer was exceedingly clever. But for whatever reason, I came out on top, and it might have been the fortune cookie at lunch with the chief accountant that said something about a good offer will be coming your way. So, while I didn't put that in the bank, it felt good at least.
Yeah. Was that John Shad? Was he in there?
John Shad was the chairman at the time. He had arrived, I think, in 1983. He was there the entire 2 years of my assignment from 84 to 86. And I think in 87 he was gone, and I'm trying to remember who followed him. But the point was that he was very much a Wall Street. I remember him being the vice chairman of E.F. Hutton prior to his arrival, and so he was very much a Wall Street guy, not a deep understanding of accounting or auditing. But yet, as chairman, of course, he had to answer for everything. And it turned out that even though I had a technical role, I was told by the chief accountant to spend time with the chairman and the folks in his office to prepare him for some upcoming congressional testimony.
Let's get to that.
Okay.
Let's go back a little
sure.
bit and talk about that chief accountant. Was that Clarence Sampson?
Clarence Sampson was the chief accountant when I arrived, and I think about certainly for the first year or a little bit more. And then he retired, and Ed Colson became chief accountant thereafter. So talk about night and day. Clarence and Ed were both extremely talented but very different personalities. But in what ways? Well, Clarence was really very much by the book. What I really respected about when we met with public companies who had a challenge to their accounting, Clarence had a very measured way of dealing with everyone, and he always said, look, if the company has substantial authoritative support for its position, we as the SEC should not be forced to tell them they're wrong. On the other hand, if they don't have that support and we disagree with their accounting, they should be forced to change their accounting, either by restating their past financials, which of course is a sort of the horror, everyone, restating your numbers is not an experience you want to go through.
And far less common then, I would imagine.
Far less common then. A restatement in those days was, a life event in a corporation's sort of history in that time. So the question always became, if we didn't prefer their accounting, were we going to make them restate because it was wrong and not supported, or were we going to make a strong suggestion that going forward they change their accounting to a different method? And there was always a tension between the chief accountant's office, who made the final call on that question, and the folks in the Division of Corporation Finance, who probably reviewed the filing discovered the issue and raised it in the first instance with the company. But through the process of appealing, it ended up on the, in the office of the chief accountant, and oftentimes that led to a conference where the company and its lawyers and its auditors would come in, meet with the chief accountant's office, including the fellows, people in my position, mm-hmm. who probably had the lead, and then the folks from the Division of Corporation Finance who were reviewing the filing and had, you know, what we would call an open comment letter process. In other words, an unresolved comment. So that was always the final meeting. Was the conference and the related answer.
Well, we were talking a little bit about the process of your dealing with a registrant who sort of stuck up on mm-hmm. Clark Fenn's radar screen. And what picked my interest is you talked about there always being a tension between the chief accountant's office and the Clark Fenn people.
Well, yes. And I'm speaking very specifically, and some of this goes to personalities, but there's no question that that one division of the commission had challenged the accounting. In other words,
right.
through a series of interrogatories back and forth, saying, you know, we're concerned about or we are asking questions about accounting, and eventually unsatisfied that the company had, appropriately responded to remove the concern, then the question is you're a bit of you're loggerheads at that point between the company and Clark Fenn. Then the question is the company going to pursue this by appealing it to the front office in Corp Fin, the chief accountant of the Division of Corporation Finance, and depending on how that goes, at least in those days, then to the office of the chief accountant, who was the chief accounting officer for the entire SEC. And indeed, that was often the outcome, partly because, restatements were a big deal. They still are, in my view, but in those days, they were even more rare. And the consequences of a restatement between maybe not being able to go to the market for a while or litigation or anything that could flow from that, companies tended to pursue it to the highest authority. Technically, even if the chief accountant disagreed with the company, you could pursue it to the commission itself. But at that point, that was not a very common practice, having the entire staff of the SEC on one side and you on the other. You know, the commission's going to... be very circumspect before agreeing with the company.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about your job. Now, I get the sense that the professional accounting fellows were able to undertake projects and things like that, or did you just sort of weave into the pattern of everyday work?
We tended to be in the office in those days, which was maybe certainly less than 20, including administrative types, 15 people, four of whom of that compliment were professional accounting fellows. So what tended to happen was that the big issues that created volume, call volume and policy question volume and so forth, were sort of assigned. So for my 2 years, business combinations was my area. So mergers and acquisitions accounting effectively. And in that capacity, I spent a lot of time with the national offices of each of the large firms. I spent a lot of time making presentations on panels, working with the AICPA and its various committees, but taking that subject matter, kind of all the way through wherever it would interface with people on the outside or even people on the inside. So if you were the business combinations lead, all those questions would essentially end up on your desk, and you would work with permanent staff, with deputy chief accountants and the chief accountant to formulate a point of view, either on a registrant-specific question or there's an emerging issue. How are we going to deal with that? What's the SEC's position going to be on some new twist or turn on business combination accounting?
What was the balance between making concrete decisions about things that have already happened or trying to set up for emerging issues?
Well, I think... It was the majority of it was registrant questions. Whether it's 60-40 or 70-30, I don't know. But during that same time in 1984, I attended with Clarence Sampson, chief accountant at the time, the inaugural meeting of the FASB's Emerging Issues Task Force. That was a brand new process, and because there was a lot of volume and getting resolution quickly so people could have guidance was a problem. So the EITF met for the first time in 1984, and I remember traveling with Sampson to that meeting as chief accountant. He had what would they call it, observer status with privilege of the floor. So if the direction wasn't going well in his mind, he could say, well, that's all well and good, but the SEC will never accept that, for example. Would tend to set the tone.
A FASB group?
It was a FASB group. It still exists today, although it meets much less frequently. This used to be on a cadence of, every 8 weeks or so they would meet on emerging issues.
Now, you're coming off the big merger wave and the M&A stuff, the takeovers of the early 80s. Was that what was driving this necessarily?
Well, it was a combination of, what I call merger and acquisition accounting, or business combinations as the accountants like to call it. But also, the explosion of financial products was beginning to take shape. The Wall Street, I'll call it the engineered product. All kinds of defeasance deals with debt, packaging together a new security that had some equity elements, some debt elements, zero coupon, pick preferred stocks. I mean, all kinds of things where they were hybrids. And the question came to the fore, how does the issuer account for that? Like a debt security? Like an equity instrument? Where does it go on the balance sheet? Is it in equity or is it outside of equity? I mean, all these questions were accelerating as Wall Street was becoming more creative. And that period from the, say, 83, 84, all the way through October of 87, when the market took its turn, that was, the budding industry on Wall Street. And so a lot of those things would come to the SEC, including, I would use a little example, happens to be a client of mine today at Deloitte. But in those days, the General Motors merger with EDS, Electronic Data Systems, and their new Class E stock, the SEC had to deal with that on how the heck do you compute earnings per share when you've got a unique security like that. So those kinds of things were very routine in our office in those days.
Now, presumably, accountants and firms out there are having to make decisions about how they're going to handle this before.
Yes.
The EITF is able to weigh in. How is that working out? Would you sit everybody down and say, well, here's how we did it, here's how we did it, and try to come to an agreement?
Well, if you're, let's say you're, I'll just make this up, you're a Fortune 50 company, you've got some unique accounting question. Once you've sort of researched it and you think you know what the answer is, you're going to talk to your auditor. But if the stakes are high, there were a couple of choices in those days, and there are probably a couple of choices these days as well. Should we go to the SEC and go directly to the Office of the Chief Accountant and get, I call it the insurance policy, by pre-clearing the answer so that we're not going to be surprised in a subsequent review by Corp Fin with a lot of questions about how did you ever justify this accounting? And most mature companies, prudently would say, maybe that's a good idea. I don't want to find out after we've already done something that we've done it completely wrong. The stakes are too high. In other cases, they would say, well, this is not that big an issue. Let's use our audit firm or other people we know in the accounting profession to start vetting this through the Emerging Issues Task Force of the FASB. Those were two different routes one could take. But if it was a big deal and it had a dramatic impact on your financials, generally you couldn't wait for the Emerging Issues Task Force process, which could span multiple meetings over multiple months. In other words, it wasn't designed to be for a company-specific question, but if Wall Street came with a new product and this client, that client, and the clients over at KPMG and PricewaterhouseCoopers and Ernst & Young were seeing the same thing, sometimes the professional would put his head together and say, I don't know what the answer is. Let's all take this to the EITF so we can figure it out across the board. Now, let's get some consistency and not have firms kind of staking out different ground on the right accounting answer.
How efficient was the EITF in pulling that off?
Well, in early days when the issues were narrower, I thought it was relatively effective. I think what happened over time, in fact, I know what happened over time, You know, I remember, I think, it, you know, we started numbering the issues. It was in 1984. 84-1 was the first issue. And I, if I'm not mistaken, it was about debt defeasance or debt classification or something. The issue summary was 2 pages, and the codification of the answer was a half a page or something like that. You know, maybe off a little bit. But over time, as the complexity grew, you know, got into the 90s, some of the issue summaries were 100 pages long. They had all kinds of views, alternate A, B, C. It sort of, the issues became so heavy just to their own weight that parsing through them and getting, you know, to an answer became more and more difficult, frankly.
Is that just a matter of putting more qualifications on things, being unwilling to come down on...
Well, remember, during that entire period of time, throughout the 80s and into the 90s, more and more detailed rules were being promulgated by the FASB. So if one wanted to, I'll use the words, engineer around those requirements, it became much more complicated. And so, you know, features were added to features. And you know, it's like a Christmas tree. You start piling on, and pretty soon the whole thing falls over because it's too heavy. You know, it's laden with little things. So it just became more complicated. But... You know, as the EITF sort of came into existence, we were all very hopeful that it would be sort of the answer. Because in the years, literally, the front end there, one of the most effective vehicles the SEC had was the use of the staff accounting bulletin as a way to get something out quickly, particularly if an emerging practice appeared to be inappropriate or abusive of the accounting model. Mm-hmm. And truth is... The SEC has tremendous authority, but it's always very judicious in utilizing it. But I always thought the staff accounting bulletin, and I worked on one that had to do with repos and reverse repos, and it came to light because certain SNLs, and in those days something called Financial Corporation of America, FCA, was doing this repo-reverse repo, and practice was not consistent. And in the space of literally a week, we put out a staff accounting bulletin to provide clarity to the market. The FASB, as good as they are, they really can't do something in a week. But if there's a market abuse or something that people view as highly important, the ability of that to be written, approved by the commission, and published is a very powerful tool. And, you know, the reason I say the SEC is judicious, they're not trying to step on anyone's toes. At the same time, they have a responsibility to the investing public, and they feel that this could cause harm to investors, and they need to act quickly, and then maybe ask others to take it up on a longer-term basis.
So this is one way, these staff accounting bulletins are one way in which the SEC can really give some input and say, these are the things, you know, here's our position, you need to integrate this at some point down the road.
I mean, once it's published, it's effective. I mean, this is a really powerful tool. You know, one of the things I always think about the SEC is they self-declare. Look, we're a disclosure agency. So they don't often dictate requirements, but they might say, I'll give you an example. They're not going to tell companies that they must have a separate chairman and CEO, but they are going to put out a disclosure rule that says, describe whether you have a separate chairman and CEO, and if you don't, why does that make sense in your particular circumstance? So it's this form of regulation. It's kind of like audit committees in the 70s. Well, you may not need an audit committee, but if you don't have one, could you please explain or disclose why you don't? You know, it's all designed to change behavior, only because in the negative, you don't want to be the one to say, we don't want an audit committee, or you know, it's I'm sure there's a term of art for it, but it's trying to change behavior by requiring disclosure.
Interesting. Was that a surprise when you came into the SEC?
It was very much a surprise because to me, you know, at least in concept, and I was a young man, of course, at the time, was, you know, the SEC is sort of the supreme authority, and you know, I think the most interesting discussions I've ever taken part in were all within the SEC in private, where there was a debate involving all the senior people at the SEC, and I'm taking the commissioners out of this for a minute, saying that the division directors, the general counsel, the chief accountant, the head of Corp Fin, debating on what authority the commission really had under the statute, and whether if they took something too far, whether someone in the public would challenge that authority, litigate it, in other words, and say, SEC, we don't believe you had the authority to take that action and make this requirement. And there were, and even today, as I think various chairmen, various alums of the SEC, there are almost sort of two camps as to how much authority the SEC really has. I've always been in the camp that it may be a political decision not to utilize it, but I think in terms of what the Congress has granted the SEC, they have tremendous authority, but they're very judicious about using it.
Hmm. Privilege of the floor, that was a term you used before.
Yes.
Did you ever see that invoked?
Absolutely. It's often been the case, and even today, we have, I'll give you a current day example. Coming out of Sarbanes-Oxley, the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board was formed to be a direct regulator of the auditing profession, the profession that audits public companies.
Right.
And, you know, they have a standing advisory group that meets several times a year. I served on it for a number of years in the early days. And the SEC had an observer. The General Accounting Office has an observer. The chairman of the FASB is an observer. There are a number of folks that are invited to the table. And all a privilege of the floor means is that they have the right to speak. So if the group has got a consensus going on some issue, and there's no votes, but it's an informative group, what the SEC says in those meetings or what others might offer as a thought, you know, tends to weigh a little more than something I might say or my colleague sitting to my left or right because of the position, the power of the position of the chief accountant. And, you know, it can literally shape the outcome without having, you know, by fiat or otherwise having to sort of force it. Just it tends to impact how people think.
Yeah.
It could be very effective.
Other FASB issues at that point. Were they still working on the conceptual framework, and were you involved in those discussions at all?
Well, I was less involved with the FASB discussions. There were regular, I don't know if they were public or non-public in those days, but there were regular meetings where members of the FASB, I think every quarter, would come and sort of review their agenda and have a discussion about, you know, where they were headed. And, you know, because remember, under ASR 173, the SEC delegated its standard-setting authority and recognized the FASB as, you know, well, they delegated the authority without abdicating their responsibility. So they still had the oversight responsibility, and they exercised that through sort of quarterly touch-base meetings with members of the FASB. You know, standard setting is not an easy business. And, you know, one of the things that I observe is that over the years, as chief accountants changed and as board chairs and board members changed and as the economic environment changed, you know, things kind of meander. They don't go in a straight line, and the complexity of the system we've built over those years is pretty significant. It's also pretty darn good. I mean, I know we're in the middle of talking about whether we should stay with FASB or go to IFRS,
mm-hmm.
But at the same time, almost every decision made and every standard promulgated was done for a reason. Which may or may not have hooked into the so-called conceptual framework. Mm-hmm. I mean, the conceptual framework was under construction for forever. Some would say if you had to start it all over again, you'd finish your conceptual framework and then you'd set your standards. But,
right.
You know.
But it didn't work out that way.
No, it's like trying to change a wheel on a moving car. You
right.
know, it's a high degree of difficulty, but.
So, and you mentioned earlier then that you had actually started to work with John Shadd himself. Tell me how that came about, what the first issues were that you were involved in.
There was a call for an oversight hearing by the Energy and Commerce Committee, which in those days, 1985, I believe, was chaired by Congressman John Dingell. And here we are in 2010 with Congressman John Dingell still in office, which is amazing. But he had some very harsh views and wanted accountability, particularly from the audit profession, on the savings and loan matters and certain very specific audits where there had been problems, you know, post issuance of the financial statements. So he called upon John Chad as the chairman of the SEC to come and explain how oversight of the auditing profession is executed by the SEC. This is not the first sort of swing at the auditing profession. In the late 70s, with Moss-Metcalf reports, a lot of questions when Harold Williams was chairman, the AICPA formed the SEC practice section. The firms would join as firms as opposed to CPAs joining as individual practitioners. And that's where we got the structure, the peer review, and all that. So that had been operating now for 6 or 8 years. I guess let's say, you know, closer to six. And now when there were problems in the marketplace, as Congress, as the committee saw it, I think they were wanting to hear from the AICPA, hear from the SEC. And so the heavy lifting for me, and I was pretty young, was trying to first and foremost educate Chairman Chad as to what the SEC does do vis-a-vis the profession. And I remember to this day writing, working with the General Counsel's office at the time, Dan Gelzer, Colleen Mahoney, people in General Counsel's office. And as a team, we put together a great piece of testimony, which I used for 10 years after that as a basic primer of how does the auditing profession work. Because it really sort of took it chapter by chapter and how things work. What are the governors, if you will, on compliance with professional standards and so forth. And I remember explicitly, let's say it was 100 pages. The chairman looked at it, read parts of it, I'm sure, certainly the front part, the executive summary, and declared to all of us, Linda Quinn was his chief of staff at the time, that he loved it, but it was too long. We had to cut it out. So we put our heads together after the chairman was off to his next meeting, and we agreed that it was perfect. So what we did was we renumbered it. We put it in chapters A, B, C, D, and we numbered the pages A1, A2, B1, B2, and he never figured it out. I think at the end he said, well, this is much better, obviously. So, the staff has its own work to do in support of the chairman, but I do remember what I would call sort of late nights of, it happens in this town all the time when there are congressional hearings, you practice your Q&A, mm-hmm. you know, and put the chairman on the spot and see what his answer is, and if it isn't quite what makes sense, you help him remember maybe how to say it better. And John Chad in those hearings, he was a table pounder a little bit, but in a really good way. He was a wonderful man. He said, I'm going to tell Chairman Dingell that if any auditor steps out of line, we're going to come down on them with hobnail boots. He loved that term.
Yeah,
and that's his term. And actually, he figured out a way to use it at the hearing. He was so proud of himself because he actually got it into the record. So, but that was probably professionally and personally one of the best experiences of my life was working with people the caliber of Linda Quinn, Colleen Mahoney, the folks in the General Counsel's office, Ed Colson, Clarence Sampson. I mean, it was just, you know, there weren't enough hours in a day, and all of us worked way too much, you know, by some standards. But the time just flew by, and every morning you'd get up, and you really believed, and I believe it to this day, it was the best job I ever had in a way. You're wearing the white hat, and you're doing the right things, and there's a lot of pride being a member of that staff, and I still see it today, but all of my colleagues that I continue to work with in different capacities in law firms and accounting firms, those of us that had time at the SEC, I think, view that as a very special credential that we carry with us with a lot of pride.
Mm-hmm. Were you still holding up the business combinations end while you were doing the work?
Of course. Yeah. Of course, although, as with everything at the SEC, once you lap your first year, you become sort of senior. And as new people come in, and so I grabbed one of the new guys, in this case a gentleman named Larry Salva, who came from Coopers & Lybrand in those days. And it's funny because today Larry is chief accounting officer of Comcast Corporation in Philadelphia, but Larry and I sort of tag team business combinations. And he became the lead guy eventually, I remember having to split my time between registrant matters, policy matters, and the congressional stuff.
How much would you work with Corp Fin?
You know, the relationship with Corp Fin, if it's a good one, is one of the most effective sort of tag teams at the commission. If you in the accounting world, there was a sort of a cadre of very senior people in that, what we used to call the front office, the office of the chief accountant, Corp Fin. The gentleman that we all remember very fondly was the chief accountant when I first started, was a gentleman named Howard Hodges. Mm. And Howard, he was kind of the senior statesman of Corp Fin, had been there for a very long time, highly respected. Frankly, what I remember in part was he was often the one who would be a little bit red-faced when Clarence Sampson in those registrant meetings would say, I don't really like your accounting, but you've got substantial authoritative support, so I can't tell you to restate. And, of course, Howard was looking for just the opposite answer. So the body language was classic. You know, I could just tell he was starting, the smoke was coming out of his ears a little bit at the end of the meeting. But it was the disagreements, it was the debates that I think led to the best outcomes, because we did have different points of view, and just because you were in another officer division or you were more senior, there was nobody pulled any punches. If we felt that it was wrong, even if you're a junior person, everyone was heard, and see, that's the what I call it, the deliberative part of the SEC. That in my 2 years, I went to as many closed commission meetings as I could afford to when the enforcement cases were debated. Because in those venues, no cameras, no press, no congressmen, looking over your shoulder, but just looking at those five men and women argue the issues and the policy questions. I got to tell you, that is where my passion for policy and public policy really developed. And that's what I do today for Deloitte. But, The honest debates that would occur were stunning, and when the SEC is at its best, that's when things really can get done. I'm not going to comment on where we are today, but over the years I've seen it sort of meander. But we had some very, very strong commissioners, and John Shadd, Alana Peters, Jim Treadway. I mean, we had. We had a very strong commission, and it did change over while I was there a couple of times, but not completely.
Right.
People come and go.
Yeah. And unfortunately, the commission can't actually meet like that anymore.
Well, they still meet in private, though, and I haven't been in those rooms for, 25 years, but those decisions are still made in private. Right. While it seems odd, nobody... sort of talks about that outside the room, so I don't know exactly how it is today, but I know what I saw and how much I valued it.
Any other projects that you ended up working on during that time, or notable people that you worked with in the commission in those years?
Well, I think my takeaway as I think back. The people that I have the most respect for, and I actually that continues today, although some of them aren't with us anymore, Colleen Mahoney, Linda Quinn, John Huber, Elise Walter, of course, is a commissioner today, and at the staff level, Dan Gelzer, Angela Hall, who's now Angela Gelzer, actually. They were just such high-quality people, and at the commissioner level, developing good, sort of durable relationships with people like Jim Treadway, of course, Chairman Shadd, who's passed on now, and the people in the chief accountant's office. I just it was a very rich experience for that 2 years, and, I think what it did for me is... allowed me to work with our clients today in a more effective way, because I'm long removed from it But I absolutely understand, and I'm not being pejorative here, the regulatory mindset, the job the regulator has to execute and be accountable for, and why they think the way they do, and why that might not always line up with where corporate America is or others are. Bringing that to our clients today, I think has a lot of value. And so not only do I treasure the time, but I feel like I came away with something that is, you know, is just intrinsic to who I am, and it makes me better at what I do today.
Why did you decide to move on? I mean, could you have conceivably remained at the commission in some?
I did. At the time, this whole congressional thing was still had a tail on it, and there was a question about whether I should stay. Programmatically, you would have to get a new job.
Right.
You know, the way it works, and there's a couple instances where folks have maybe stayed on another 6 months, another 8 months, but it was just too complicated, is the honest truth. And plus I had an offer to go back to in those days Deloitte Haskins and Sells and become a partner, and it did appeal to me, and back to New York, which was nice, and so I took that. Then the question comes, well, now that you're an alum, when are you coming back, and in what capacity?
Huh.
You know, so a lot of the people who have filled the division director roles have had some earlier segment of their career where they've got SEC experience, so they kind of know what they're getting themselves into. So from time to time, I've toyed with those ideas, but, you know, as they say, I've already got a full-time job.
Right.
But you see a lot of people that, you know, I mean, look at David Becker. He's the general counsel today. He was the general counsel in 2000 when Arthur Levitt was there. So, you know, people kind of come and go from time to time. And those that do it well do it because they really, have a fondness for the agency and its mission.
Yeah. Well, you've stayed in regulation to some extent.
I have,
in a different place. So when you got back to Deloitte and you went to New York as a partner, I guess, did you find yourself looking through your regulator's glasses and having to say, now, wait a minute, let's do this differently?
To some degree. I mean, I sort of went back in a capacity as a new partner for a better part of a year, sort of heading up our accounting research group, which is where all the client questions got answered. So I was a little jaded, you know, coming with that SEC regulator mentality now, just fresh right out of the most recent experience. But it wasn't long after that where I was sent down to our, reassigned to our downtown New York office where we serve Wall Street. And I found myself literally mired in those very financial products that I was mentioning earlier with, in those days, Merrill Lynch was a client, First Boston was a client, a lot of clients. And clients would call me saying, I'm trying to design this security and it's got to do these 19 things and we've got these features to it. Now, does that work from an accounting standpoint, or what would the accounting be for this? So I spent a couple of years trying to, you know, pick through the bones of these carcasses of financial products. And in those days, there was a big push to get the accounting firms to give a letter to a Merrill Lynch or to a First Boston so they could take it and market the product saying, oh, I've got a letter from Deloitte Haskins and Sells saying this is the accounting. Well, that became a big issue, and eventually there was a big crisis in the profession about opinion shopping. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't really tell an Ernst & Young client how to do their accounting without talking to Ernst & Young. I mean, the rules changed after that. But during the time, it was pretty wild and woolly until October of 87 when the market break happened. All that stuff just came to a screeching halt for a while. At which point, I ended up being going into mergers and acquisitions and advising clients who were buying companies. Certainly, I knew the accounting well, but the tougher business issues were very interesting to me. Essentially, having come back in 86, by the time we got to 1992, I was working with a client quite a bit, helping them acquire companies, and they offered me a position as CFO. So I, for the second time in my career, left the firm. By then it was Deloitte & Touche, because the Deloitte, Haskins & Sells, Touche Ross merged in 1989. So by 92, I decided I would change stripes once again and become a CFO, which I did for about 3.5 years.
Okay. Now, I would imagine at this point you would have been getting more involved in some of the AICPA committees and things like that, the SEC Practice Committee.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about how those things worked, how they were structured, and how you, you know, undertook tasks.
Well, the structure of the profession in terms of what we were calling since 1978 self-regulation essentially had a regime whereby each firm would undergo a peer review every 3 years. And that became very institutionalized across the country, including at the state level. So many of the states passed the Uniform Accountancy Act, which required, for the state of, I don't know, Wisconsin or Illinois, that you needed to have this peer review. So, you know, there were eight large firms, but it was shrinking, you know, down to 6 to 5 to 4. And I became involved in the peer review process. We actually performed the peer review of Anderson. We performed the peer review of Pricewaterhouse, and then eventually PricewaterhouseCoopers. And I began serving on the ethics committee of the AICPA, the professional executive ethics committee, got more involved with the peer review. But eventually, I became not only the member, but the chairman of the SEC Practice Section Executive Committee. So that was the body that oversaw the whole of that structure, and we were the ones that would actually establish the requirements for membership. So one of the requirements, if you're a member firm, is you have to go through peer review. We created the standard in those days for concurring review. In other words, before a partner can sign an opinion, another partner has to go all the way through the report and the financial statements and sort of give you a second sign-off. Just within the last year, the PCOB for the first time had a professional standard for that, but its beginnings were back in the practice section. So the reason I took that, too, is it has an SEC connection. The incoming chairman of the practice section was to be Bob Herdman. Bob Herdman took the job with Harvey Pitt to be chief accountant, and that left the AICPA a little bit short. And I raised my hand and said, I'll be the chair. Of course, as it turned out, after Enron and WorldCom and Sarbanes-Oxley, I ended up being, I don't know if this is a good or bad thing, the last chair of the practice section, because we had to cede all of that over to the newly formed PCOB in 2003. So others more important than I started it in 1978, but I turned the lights off in 2003 as the final chairman.
When did you take that job on?
Somewhere around, I don't know if it was 2000, 2001.
Okay.
You know, I did it for a few years. And one of the most untold stories, but one of the more, one of the sadder experiences, or at least it gave me, tugged at me a little bit, was given what was happening to Anderson with their indictment by the Justice Department, as that firm, the wheels were starting to come off and mm-hmm. partners were leaving, firms in the network were bolting and clients were changing, is we had to go to Anderson and essentially work out a deal where they would voluntarily withdraw from the practice section. There's no reason to be in it anymore, but we didn't know where life was actually going. This was pre-Sarbanes-Oxley. And we thought, well, if a firm's been indicted criminally, how can we have them in our organization? I remember flying to Chicago and working with the senior partners there, and we just worked out a deal where they would sort of quietly withdraw and we wouldn't have to sort of vote to remove them, you know, which, you know, talk about a good firm and good people and just professionally, they're your colleagues, and to have to go deal with that was not my happiest day, but it had to be done.
Were they expecting you?
Oh, yeah, I think they were. I think they were. They knew that something had to be done. I mean, I certainly gave them a heads up that we were struggling mm-hmm. with that. And maybe at the time, it was maybe the least of their worries given all the business issues that they were facing.
Sure, sure. Now, this is a voluntary structure, right?
Yes, it was a voluntary structure.
Were there
resources? Didn't have to be in it. You didn't have to be in it. You mm-hmm. could audit a public company, but what ended up happening is if you're a major firm, I mean, as a practical matter, it would be very hard to opt out. Mm-hmm. If you were a smaller firm, a lot of people saw it as sort of a badge of honor or a credential that you were qualified to audit public companies. Now, that was never the intent of the organization, but people would small firm might have a few public companies that put in their letterhead, member AICPA SEC practice section, to show that they're sort of, they use like a credential, even though it wasn't designed for that. And it was voluntary. There was a staff. There were sort of assessments, dues, if you will, to help fund, you know, the adequacy of that.
Do you think it was adequately funded?
Well, for what it was, I think the question ultimately became the efficacy of the peer review process and the oversight of it through the what was known as the Public Oversight Board. Again, very, very good people on the POB. And, you know, it just became a question of credibility. It was all solved with Sarbanes-Oxley, but there was no question once WorldCom broke that there was going to have to be a replacement system. Sort of became a congressional reality, I guess I'll call it.
Something we missed. You became a CFO for a little while.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes.
Yeah, tell me what it was like to be looking from the other side of the desk.
Well, what I tell my partners sometimes is, okay, so I've been an auditor, I've been a client, and I've been a regulator. So I kind of have you all surrounded, right? Mm-hmm. The CFO experience was particularly difficult for me because we were forming for the first time a corporate office to sort of ride herd on several portfolio companies that the investors had purchased and put together. We sold bonds registered with the SEC during that time. So now I'm on the other side of the SEC, you know, trying to sell some paper, as they say. But I think the biggest challenge was it was kind of a fledgling operation. The businesses were very old-line businesses. They were men's tailored clothing companies. They'd been in business 70, 80, 100 years, well-established. But they didn't have the infrastructure you would need to form, you know, pension plans across the span of companies, a financial reporting, accounting function, a general counsel's office. I mean, just the treasury, the kind of stuff you needed, you know, as basics.
So you were setting up a parent company?
Parent company, exactly. Okay. And I'm sure the thought at the time was maybe someday we'll do an IPO, we'll, you know, investors will get their returns. It didn't turn out that way. Right around those times in 93, 94, and the product here was men's tailored clothing, you know. You and I are wearing men's suits today, and that'd be a pretty good business today. But when casual became, at first it was sort of a nice pair of wool slacks and a sport coat, but then it turned out to be sweatpants and a golf shirt, you know.
Yeah.
And so the business just changed very, very much in a very rapid manner. So we ended up at the end of the day going through a Chapter 11, which was its own experience for me as CFO, because I had to get all the financing in place. And, you know, I like to think, and I actually believe this is true, that because I was very candid with vendors and banks and told everybody what was going on every step of the way, I was able to make my way through that situation with my reputation intact. Certainly enough that Deloitte at the time actually asked me to entertain returning, which I thought was not even a possibility, you know. Profession is funny that way. If you're gone for a year or so, you might be able to come back. But I was gone almost 4 years.
Okay.
It's just that, and this was 1996, I returned. I mean, there's no question of all the smart choices I've made. Coming back was the best thing that could have happened. I really missed the culture of the partnership and being partners with a lot of people, frankly.
Right.
But this is very different than a corporate environment.
Right. And you've already established, you're not really on the audit side of the house. You're doing opinions and things like that.
Well,
can you describe that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, what happened on my return is I headed up our SEC group, which are people that help our clients negotiate through the SEC reviews. But then after that, I also took on Auditor Independence Department. I took on the head of professional practice. I became the chief risk officer of the firm. But eventually, as deputy CEO of the what we call our corporate group, or Deloitte LLP, I'm not really in the audit business or the tax business or the consulting business, but I sit at a level that kind of spans all those businesses. So while I have my legacy and my history in audit, I'm also responsible for regulatory matters that could impact our tax practice or our consultants or anybody else. So I've got a very different job today. But because of my relationships at the SEC and other places here in Washington, I've always retained the sort of leadership of all of our regulatory efforts in order to have it be, you know, a cogent approach, at least I hope it is. I've ever since my years at the SEC, have just always gravitated toward that side of the business.
Okay. Well, the big thing we haven't talked about is the change in the profession. Mm-hmm. Over the years. And you talked about what happened to Arthur Andersen. And some people put it in terms of, you know, sort of the principles evolving into more and more rules, which is something that you've talked about.
Right.
Can you give me some sense of your experience with those changes in the profession?
You know, you can almost... Ken, you can almost separate it into eras almost on a timeline. I mean, if I look back and I look at the 45 years when the profession was, I think it's fair to say, unregulated. In other words, was each firm was left to its own, conscience and policies and integrity. And then the SEC practice section coming in for 25, 27 years as a self-regulated model. And then since 2003... first time a model of direct regulation. It's kind of one of those where I wouldn't know if I had to add another segment on what it would look like and still have us be viable as a profession, because we're directly regulated now by the PCOB, inspected annually if you're a big firm, we're registered there, which registration in the worst case could be canceled or pulled, if you will, and you wouldn't have the right to audit public companies. In the years prior, you know, we practiced before the SEC, but we were never really registered with. We weren't really directly regulated. We were, our behavior was regulated, and enforcement could force a firm or a partner not to practice before the SEC. But all of that's very implicit now in the new regime.
Right.
And I found a couple of things have been self-evident. One, it's different. It's much more. I'll use the word invasive, but I mean it's more palpable. I mean, you certainly are aware of the direct regulation. The inspection regime is much more rigorous than the peer review ever was, partly because it's annual. You know, when you're on a three-year cadence, it's one thing, but to have it's sort of continuous because an inspection takes a number of months, and while you're working on the report, you're planning the next inspection. So that's a very different dynamic. And, you know, I think it served to really get our attention as firms, and I sort of speak for everyone in this, in that we have a constant list of things we're working on to improve quality, to make changes, and, you know, I liken it to our clients who now under Sarbanes-Oxley have to maintain their internal controls, constantly report on them as management, constantly have them audited. The list of repairs and maintenance items on internal controls, there may be 10, 15, 20 of them, and as soon as that list is complete, new ones will arise. It's a constantly changing inventory of works in process. And I think that's just the continuous improvement nature of auditing or maintaining controls. You're never finished, and because economies change and issues change and clients change, there's always something that you're working on in terms of policy improvements or new training or new techniques and so forth.
What about Sarbanes-Oxley? How did that change the way you did business?
Well, first and foremost, to what I just said, the introduction of the PCOB as a direct regulator.
Right.
That was the most visible and most noticeable. But in addition, I think it forced our clients and, frankly, our auditors to get, you know, what I call sort of back to basics. Internal controls, in 1980 or so after the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, was right at the forefront of auditing. I remember spending hours on these control analyses. And what happened through the 80s and 90s, in my view, is that companies and even the auditors sort of lost their way a little bit because there was merger mania, but the control mechanisms weren't always rationalized, the systems weren't always rationalized, and repairs and maintenance of effective control systems took a back seat to other things. And so auditors found it was just as easy not to rely on the controls at all, but do a little more testing. Well, when that happened, you know, there was a disconnect between the audit work and the controls. There was a disconnect between the financial statements and certain elements of control. And it was until Sarbanes-Oxley, when we all had to step up again, that we realized how much deferred maintenance was really in the system and how much our clients needed to spend to get them up to snuff. And, you know, we were living with that from 2004, 5, 6, 7, and now I feel like we're finally in 2010 at a steady state. And one that has some discipline around it, so we shouldn't fall back down, is my point. And I think that was one of the most effective impacts of Sarbanes-Oxley, whether the framers really realized it or not. It's a lasting impact, and I think it's hugely positive.
Another thing that caused people to spend a lot of money was Section 404.
Well, that is, in fact, what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Now...
But on the other hand, there's a sense that some of that had to be scaled back.
Well, there certainly was a feeling that we were being too granular, we were digging too deep, and the stories about, you know, trying to audit the coffee money and the postage stamps started to, you know, rattle around the halls of Capitol Hill and other places. But what ended up happening was actually a great example of collaboration. The PCAOB took another look at its standard. The SEC put out some guidance. The profession actually informed those two agencies, I'll call them, as to what we were seeing in our practice and in the field, what was working and what wasn't. And even though it doesn't get much play or recognition, you know, I feel that the profession, being honest with the regulators, providing some soft suggestions on how they might frame some of this stuff, caused people to sort of relax a little bit, not in a negative way, but to feel more confident that we could get what was needed and what was intended by Congress without digging every little dark corner and...
Right.
You know,
well, what were you finding? That's sort of the what I'm trying to get at.
Well, I think what was happening, and you know, others would definitely not agree with this, that the PCAOB ended up writing what I would call the perfect standard in their audit standard number 2, which was the governing document. It was perfect in the sense that it was comprehensive. It was undeniably logical. But it really didn't provide for a lot of, I'll just say, judgment or prioritizing what were really the important things. I mean, it had the right techniques to talk about material weaknesses, significant deficiencies, and just plain old garden variety deficiencies, but the application of it was so literal. And the fear was, of course, this was a brand new regime, that the firms didn't do it perfectly, they would be criticized in their inspections. Mm. And what happened is everybody sort of took a breath and said, well, wait a minute. You know, we're not out to kill corporate America with cost here. We certainly do want to find everything that's material. But we found sort of better ways to prioritize our work. We found better ways to make certain we didn't miss material breaches of control. And we found that some of the detailed testing was... could be scaled back, could be moderated, could be done more selectively, or even on a rotational basis. And we didn't lose any integrity to what the objective was. And so that was a good thing. So in 2005 and 2006, you know, we kind of realized that something had to be done. So in 2007, 8, and 9, we've kind of settled into a place that's better. And I've seen the costs from 2004, which was year one, mm-hmm. are probably only 30% of what they were in year one. So, I mean, it's moderated down to a level that, you know, feels right. But now the Congress just exempted permanently the companies that are $75 million in market cap and below. My own view is that's unfortunate, even though I certainly respect small business. Those same companies take the public's money as well, and they may be the less well-controlled companies. So there may be a little more risk there, but... we're not going to know, because unless they voluntarily choose to have their controls audited, that will not be an SEC requirement ever. It had been deferred for many years, but now it's just off the table.
It's interesting. You were talking about the insight that you got and you carry with you from being in the SEC, but here's an example of where you were maybe a little surprised by what the commission position the commission took. Does that happen very often?
Well... Sometimes. I mean, I think there's, I think the political realities are at play here. There's no question that in our, in the world right now, in 2010, everyone's concerned about smaller businesses, about economic recovery, about job creation, and yet, you know, the SEC is in that tough spot where they have to be the investor's advocate. They have to protect investors, and you know, the greater public policy or you know, sort of the greater good theory is all fine, well and good, but they're going to be held accountable for regulating the capital markets and public companies. And, you know, I think they've been really good to not lose sight. And, in fact, even though they'll accept what Dodd-Frank has required, I don't believe that was something the SEC was, you know, they were certainly pounding the table to get that. I think they, others influenced the Congress to take that step. And now the SEC is, as they always are, faced with implementing the law.
Right. The other thing the SEC is faced with is convergence.
Mm-hmm.
And the sort of internationalization, I guess. And that would seem to be an awfully big wave that's heading towards firms like yours.
Sure.
Tell me what you're doing and how you're working with the SEC and the rest of the profession to deal with that.
It's a great question. In terms of what we're doing at Deloitte or any of the other firms are needing to do, one of our realities that surprises a lot of people is that right here in the United States, a significant percentage of our auditors, even if the U.S. never moves to IFRS, we have to have our U.S. auditors trained and sort of qualified in IFRS. Why? Because let's say your assignment tomorrow is go audit, you know, for the next 2 months, go audit this subsidiary of our U.K. client in Atlanta. Or go to the West Coast and audit the operation that's owned by the French company that's a client over in France. But, oh, by the way, the financial package you have to report is all in IFRS. They may be resident here, but, you know, roll the clock forward 2-3 more years. Canadian companies, Mexican companies, Japanese companies, all those companies that operate here in the U.S. and need audit work are going to be done under IFRS because all their parent companies and parent countries have converted. So even if we want to stay out of the fray and just say, you know, leave us alone, it's not possible. The U.S. is brought into this by necessity. And, you know, we didn't know 10 years ago where this was going. However, it's pretty obvious that it's either the U.S. against the world or the U.S. In other words, there's no way U.S. GAAP is going to become the standard at this point, given the reality of what's happened. I think the most important thing, and I'm a great believer in the preeminence of the U.S. capital markets, and people can argue against that, but I still think we have the most efficient markets. And I think that our power to influence outcome on accounting and financial statement issues and so forth will be diminished if we don't get a seat at the table in terms of setting the standards under IFRS. And I think that's exactly what Mary Shapiro and the Commission are asking the staff to complete with this work plan, you know, in its 5 or 6 phases, to come to a determination next year about where we're going to go and how we might get there. It's feeling to me, and it's just a feeling, that, you know, the SEC eventually will determine that on some time frame, IFRS will be incorporated into the system. So, you know, I think it's a good thing. Others might disagree. I think our clients are worried this is another 404, but it couldn't be further from the truth. Because unlike 404 that has an annual piece to it, this conversion, if you will, is more or less a one-time. And, you know, I'm a CFO of a big conglomerate located in Detroit. I've got countries all over the world now keeping their books on IFRS. And I've got to now convert them back to U.S. GAAP in order to consolidate them. Well, if we were all on IFRS, I could have common sets of controls, common sets of, you know, chart of accounts, those kinds of things. And, you know, the risk of mistakes in conversion and flipping it back and forth kind of go away in favor of a more uniform system. So I think there are a lot of advantages. I know there are people on both sides of this issue, and I respect those other points of view. But it feels to me like the profession can do a lot to help the SEC with information to complete its work plan, so it can do a fair evaluation in front of the commission. And some of us are, you know, doing our best to help in that regard.
Is there a structure within which you're doing that?
Well, we certainly have in the last, few years, we formed the Center for Audit Quality here in Washington, which is an adjunct organization to the AICPA, but it's separate. Its sole focus is public company auditing. So it really doesn't have to do with tax preparers or private company audits or anything like that, or bookkeeping. It really is focused on the public company audit space. We as firms spend a lot of time using that as sort of our vehicle for collaboration on issues that involve the SEC and the PCAOB. And it's been a very credible, it's been very successful in my mind to make sure the firms, and we all have to volunteer, you know, some of our smartest resources, but I probably spend 20 to 30% of my time with my colleagues in the other firms working together on issues that matter. And you're always better off when you do that as opposed to kind of going your own way.
Right. Well, is there anything else that we haven't talked about that we should get to at this point?
No, I think the conversation's been very sweeping in its scope and interesting for me to participate in. I'm delighted to have had that opportunity. But the thing I guess that I just can't let go of is I'm very proud to have spent a little part of my career working at the SEC.
Terrific. Thanks.
You're welcome.